Once again, I'll attempt to spare 5 minutes to at least set it aside for rebuttal. I'm reminded at the end of the day what Judge Morrison pointed out, his remedy was the art of effective advocacy. I've never learned that lesson, but he used to point it out with great frequency when I was involved. Once again, this is a case coming out of Norfolk Circuit Court. It's a case of King Martin versus Commonwealth. Mr. Martin was convicted of two offenses, both occurring on the same day, May 3rd, 2000, credit card theft, a felony credit card fraud. Basically, the facts themselves are fairly straightforward. The assignment of error basically goes to an evidentiary ruling. There was an admission of a set of bank documents. There were 8 separate documents. They all looked fairly, they all looked the same, but they dealt with different transactions pertaining to a particular bank account, and they were admitted as one document, as Commonwealth Exhibit 1, over the defense objection that it was hearsay.
And those documents were computer-generated. They were not specially created.
We don't know how they were generated, basically, and therein lies the problem. The way the documents were admitted, the son of the victim, who's an elderly gentleman, my client at one point in that time frame lived in the same rooming house, actually lived in the alleged victim's room and helped him do his daily functions, including helping with making bank transactions with the card and the like. That, you know, sufficiency evidence is not on the table. The only reason this is important is because the AG has alleged that if it was error, it was harmless. And so you do have to understand the factual the footprint of this thing, I think. Essentially, son takes father to bank, funds look a little less than they anticipated. He gets a transaction, according to him, he gets a transaction sheet from the teller. And he identified it as this Prosecution Exhibit 1 or Commonwealth 1.
Which is a printout.
Which is a series of cards. I think these are printouts, 8 separate printouts. He takes it to the police detective, and this is his testimony. He took it to the police detective, and the police detective took those documents, and based on that, police detective initiated investigation. The detective's testimony was, those are not what he brought me initially. He brought me a document. I told him it wasn't enough, and a couple weeks later, he showed back up with these documents. And these are the documents that he used to do his investigation, and he based in part his testimony on those documents. The documents were admitted over objection as bank records. The Commonwealth made no attempt to lay any foundation. You know, it was clearly perceived as coming in as a business record. The Commonwealth established a quote chain of custody, although as I just pointed out, his team and his chain of custody was faulty because there was no explanation for the difference in the dates. And the dates on the documents, the generation date, says they were generated on May the 17th, not May the 3rd.
Counsel?
May 7th, I think. Actually, the date that I think the son said they were at the bank was May the 7th. So, yes,
let me ask you this. Assuming we agree with you that they were inadmissible, why isn't it harmless error in light of the officer's testimony?
Because the officer didn't testify about anything having to do with those documents, independent of the documents itself. You go back and read his testimony, and that's another piece of a rat I need to do. Basically, in my reply brief, I noted the place in the appendix where the officer testified about the contents of those documents, and I said 57 and 58. That's wrong. That's the transcript page number. It was actually on pages 73 and 74 of the appendix, and I apologize. As I go through life, I find I make more and more of these kind of errors. I don't know whether it's eyesight or just general lapse of memory. But in any event, if you read the 2 pages of testimony, it's clear he doesn't provide one piece of substantive testimony concerning what's on those documents. He makes reference to those documents.
But there was no objection to that testimony.
No, well, how could there be? The door ejected to the document. All he's doing when he's testifying is looking at this document. We have a 16-digit account number, and I matched the last 4 digits of that 16-digit account number to the receipt I got from the 7-Eleven.
Isn't there an obligation to object to the testimony of the officer if you're going to argue later that it was only based on records that were inadmissible?
I don't see how you, it would be a cumulative. Why would you object to his testimony? He didn't say anything. He didn't present any independent evidence. All he said is, if you look at that number on the document, you'll see that the last four digits of that 16-digit okay. account number matches the four digits on the charge ticket.
So you're basically saying, how do I object to something that's already been admitted?
It's already been ruled on. I mean, basically, once the government, or the Commonwealth, and I'm sorry, I used to do federal litigation, it sometimes slips up on me. But basically, once the Commonwealth has admitted a document, all the officer's doing is saying, look at this document, and you see this information. He's not, that's not substantive testimony. It's not all, his testimony is not being altered for the truth of the assertion as to that matter. He's simply saying, Judge, if you look at that number and you look at the transaction listed on that date, it coincides with the transaction at 7-Eleven. Without that information on those transaction cards, there is nothing, because the victim didn't testify about what his bank account number was. The only evidence of the bank account number is on that. And the police officer didn't testify about it either, by the way. Basically, all he said was, look at the card, you see this number, and you look at this receipt. He didn't provide any independent evidence, and he didn't have any personal knowledge anyway. I mean, he wasn't, and that's why the two cases cited by the AG are simply inapplicable. You got Pope and Whited. Pope was a trooper. The objection at trial was that to his notes, because he was testifying about personal observations, but apparently there was some indication he was referring to his notes. That the notes were objected to. They never objected to the officer's personal, to the officer's testimony, and the notes were never offered in evidence. So, that was the problem in Pope. That's not applicable here. Whited was the traditional thing where the lab report didn't get filed on time, so they called this was before we had all the Sixth Amendment problems, and they were objecting to the fact that filing wasn't done on time, and that's not an objection to the chemist's testimony. You don't have to file the chemist if he shows up and testifies. It's just his personal observation. And there was some, they tried to change their objection on appeal to object, saying we not only objected to the certificate, but we objected to the testimony of the chemist. Well, a violation of the filing requirements, that doesn't keep the chemist's testimony out, and they didn't make that objection at trial in the first place. So that also is not what we have here.
Did the trial judge take judicial notice?
Trial judge, they had a very confusing interchange between the two attorneys and the trial judge, but she didn't take judicial notice of anything. I don't know what she could have taken judicial notice of.
The computer-generated nature of the...
But we don't know. I mean, computer-generated means it's something that was generated at the time of the transaction by human interaction, and there is nothing to show that that's how these documents, the information in the documents were generated. We don't know how this was generated. We don't know what generated it. It has a reference to the World Wide Web, Internet Explorer on the top of the documents. We don't know how these documents were generated. Now, the AG has also suggested, hey, let's use Penny. That first off, that was never brought to, that was never suggested to the trial judge, and no foundation. And Penny does require foundation. One, you have to show it is a machine generated. I mean, what machine generates means if you go to your ATM machine and you type in a transaction and the bank record, the computer automatically deposits that into the records, that's that would qualify under Penny as a computer generated document, but we've got no evidence that that's how this information was. We don't know how this information was generated because the Commonwealth didn't attempt to lay any foundation at all. And not only do you have to show how it was generated, you have to show that the way it's done is both accurate and reliable. Since we have no information about how the information was generated, that foundational requirement on the Penny hasn't been met here either.
Did the son testify in this case?
The son testified, but he didn't testify about the bank account. He didn't testify about how, all he said is, I got that from a bank teller.
What about the 7-Eleven receipt?
There's nothing, no problem with the 7-Eleven receipt, but that's the back end of this transaction. The tie that binds, the only thing that puts the victim's money, credit card, on the line at 7-Eleven is the transaction statement from the bank that shows the account number and the dollar of the transaction. You take that out, all you've got is that my client was using a bank card at 7-Eleven. and we don't know whose bank card it was, and we don't know what amount, but we don't know how that relates to the alleged victim, because what tied the two transactions together was the account number on the victim's account and the dollar of the transaction and the date, which coincided with the 7-Eleven transaction. If the documents are not admissible, all you got is my client using a bank card at somebody's, or supposedly his, at a 7-Eleven, and you got his smiling face while he's doing so. And that's it. I mean, that's the problem. They, you know, the AG also suggested it's harmless because it didn't mean anything. Well, it means everything. It's the only thing that ties the transaction at the 7-Eleven to the alleged victim and his bank account. And if you don't have that, you've got nothing. You know, simply there is no, you know, there's no proof that my client, it was his credit card, or that he wasn't using his own credit card, and both offenses fall right there, because you can't prove the identity without those bank documents. Finally, the AG suggested, if it's not harmless error, bank generated, I think I've dealt with that one. And the second aspect, which I really enjoyed, because I did used to do federal practice, and 807 was always an interesting rule to me. You know, basically, if you can't do it any other way, Commonwealth, get something close and maybe we'll let you do it. But of course, it requires certain specific steps, not applicable in Virginia. We chose not to adopt 807 or anything that's close to 807. We still go by the standard old common, essentially common law rules of hearsay. You got to fit into something we recognize or a very close proximity, and this isn't one. And the problem with the machine-generated argument is it does require a foundation. And to suggest that we can kind of shoehorn this into it by making certain inferences, the record is not complete in that regard. And we know that's a right result for the wrong reason, and that doesn't apply because what? We need additional evidentiary foundation, which would require a trier of fact to make that in those determinations. You can't do that. It's not in the record. So, I like to say this is the case where I'm arguing against affirmative defenses. The Commonwealth essentially has conceded this was hearsay. It wasn't the foundation of the business record. Didn't happen. And let's see if we can find some other reason to save this case. Unfortunately for the Commonwealth, there isn't any good one. Basically it is not harmless error. It is the fundamental element of proof of the use of my client of the alleged victim's card. Without it, you don't have an account number, you don't have any match between his funds and that account number in the transaction they relied on to say my client was fraudulently using the card and had possession of the card. And neither of the arguments he made, it failed to object to the detective's testimony. That doesn't work because the officer didn't make any independent testimony. Basically to have stated an objection, Judge, to go back to what you said, would be the equivalent of requiring the defendant to keep objecting every time that docket was passed around the courtroom, and we know we don't have to do that anymore. And neither one of the exceptions he argued apply. It's not shown to be a computer generated because it's not shown that this was automatically generated by a machine. We don't know how it was generated. That's not in the record. It may be, but that requires additional foundation, and once again, that we can't do that because it requires a further evidentiary showing that's not in this record.
Thank you, sir.
May it please the court, Chris Chandler for the Commonwealth. In his trial and his petition and his opening brief, Mr. Martin has never challenged whether or not the officer's testimony, Detective Perry's testimony in this case, was admissible. All that has been challenged at every stage is whether or not the documents themselves were admissible. If you read the trial transcript, if you read the petition for appeal, if you read the opening brief, time and time again, there are objections to the documents, time and time again. The significance of that is borne out in this court's decision in Pope versus Commonwealth. I would encourage the court to read that case very carefully, and the court has in anticipation of this argument, but once again, because I think that the representation of Pope versus Commonwealth made in Mr. Martin's reply brief is just simply incorrect. The facts in Pope versus Commonwealth are meaningfully similar to this case in every relevant way. Now, I'll go through a couple of those. First of all, he argues here on appeal That it would have been unnecessary for him to make an additional challenge to Detective Perry's testimony because he'd already challenged the documents. If you read Pope versus Commonwealth, the way that the trial played out there is exactly the way it played out in this particular case, where you had, before the Commonwealth's second witness, the officer in that case was allowed to testify, before he even got anything out, there was an objection made by the defense that we think this officer's going to testify based on his notes, and we have an objection to those notes. And so the court considered the objection to the notes. Eventually, the court overruled the objection and said the notes are admissible, and then the officer was allowed to testify. He testified based on what was in his notes, and there was never any objection during his testimony to the substance of his testimony. And on appeal, this court held that because the only objection in that case was to the notes and the admissibility of the notes and not to the testimony, that objection was waived for failure under 5A18 to make a contemporaneous objection. So I would submit that is the exact same procedural posture. We got to where we are today in this case, the exact same way the court got there in Pope versus Commonwealth, and we're just submitting that the outcome should be the same. The second attempt that Mr. Hart attempts to make to distinguish Pope versus Commonwealth is this claim that in Pope, all of the officer's testimony was based on his own notes and based on his own personal observations. However, if you read the facts in Pope versus Commonwealth, you'll see that's actually the opposite of what's stated there in that opinion. I hate to read from cases, but I'd like to just do that real briefly if the court will forgive. Before testimony from the Commonwealth's second witness, and this is at pages 501 through 502 of 60 VAF, before testimony from the Commonwealth's second witness, the trial court allowed the defense counsel, to address appellant's objection to Trooper Roseberry using certain portions of his original handwritten notes from the investigation into the victim's rape and murder. Trooper Roseberry's notes included information regarding the evidence he received from Harrell, so a different officer, and the notes identified items and listed where in the victim's home this other officer maintained that he had found those items. So the trooper was testifying based on his notes, and his notes contained statements that he had heard from a different officer about where this different officer had recovered evidence in the home. And then the court goes on to say that Trooper Roseberry, the officer testifying, admitted he made these notes after speaking with Harrell and did not have any additional personal knowledge regarding those items of evidence and their original locations within the victim's home. So I would submit that is exactly what we have in this case, that there, in that case, there was clear hearsay in the officer's notes. In this case, there's alleged hearsay in these bank statements. In both cases, there's objection to the notes, but not objection to the testimony. And
well, would you agree or concede that we're dealing with hearsay in this case?
I don't concede that it's hearsay, because I don't think we have an out-of-court declarant. And that gets to the merits response in my brief, that these are computer-generated records.
And the claim has been that there's insufficient evidence for us to conclude that these were machine-generated documents.
And I would submit as to that, while yes, I would have loved to have someone from the bank who dealt with our software to come in and testify, this is how our software works, and this is how we record transactions that are made at gas stations, I would submit that fact finders are allowed to rely upon their common sense. And all of us who've ever made a transaction at a gas station know that when we swipe our debit card and get a receipt and then walk away, the person who rang us up is not getting on the phone and making a phone call to our bank to tell the bank, you know, all the details of the transaction that just went down, so that someone, a human, can input that information into the bank's records.
Can we tell from the face of the exhibit that this was a machine-generated document?
The face of the exhibit does state that it was a pinless point-of-sale purchase that was made. We know that the purchase was made using a debit card. We know that it was made at a 7-Eleven store. I think we have to rely on common sense as to whether or not the person ringing him up and then or someone at the bank was actually typing in all of this information, the date when the transaction occurred, the place, the fact that it was at a 7-Eleven, the time.
Assuming that it was machine generated, then, and Penny suggests, as I recall, that there needs to be a foundation of reliability. How do you address the reliability of this machine generated document?
Well, so a two-part response to that question. The first part is that if you look at footnote 3 in the Penny case, this requirement that the specific machine that was used is reliable is premised on the fact that in Penny they were dealing with a call trap device, which was used specifically for investigatory purposes in anticipation of litigation. And so in footnote 3, this court stated in Penny that our requirement of this proof of reliability for the specific device is necessary here in the process of ferreting out criminal activity, but it may not be necessary to other cases where computer-generated information is generated and not in the investigatory process. And that's exactly what we have here with bank records. The time that these statements, the information in the statements was originally generated, there was no investigation going on whatsoever. So you look at the final sentence in footnote 3 of Penny, which says under different circumstances, where the situation suggests that computer-generated results possess sufficient indicia of reliability, then the burden of requiring reliability for each individual program or device may outweigh its utility. So if it's not in the process of preparing for litigation, you can simply ask, not was this particular device reliable, but is there anything in the situation that we can rely upon to infer that these are reliable documents?
Was there any testimony in this case to the effect that these were automatically generated machine records that were done in the normal course of business as opposed to being prepared for use in litigation?
There was no testimony about when they were prepared. However,
so we would have to infer that from
the allow the fact finder to make the inferences from the fact that these records were being, the information in the records was appearing on the computer screen as they were at the bank. These statements from these May 3rd purchases, the teller was seeing them appearing on the screen at the time. And of course, we know that at that time, no investigation had occurred because there was no knowledge that there was any sort of wrongdoing until they got to the bank.
Well, there were two separate sets of records, I understand. One that was the one sheet that was given on the first day at the bank, and then 7 or 8 pages at some point thereafter, a week or more after.
Correct. And I would submit that in response to that question, the important date for the court's consideration as to whether these records were prepared in the course of investigation is not when the actual records, a hard copy, was printed out, but when the information in those records, which is what's being objected to, was generated. And we know this information as to when the purchases were made. I think we can know this common sense. You don't go to a gas station and make a purchase and then have to wait 2 weeks before you see on your bank statement whether that purchase, you know, went through, your bank has a record of it. That's all happened simultaneously.
Is there any requirement to authenticate the printouts themselves?
I think that, I mean, with all evidence, there's some authenticity requirement, but I think
where was
that,
it here?
In the testimony, so there was testimony from,
because an officer can't authenticate a bank's records.
Well, I think an officer's testimony by itself may not have been enough if he had just said, these are some records I got from, you know, from these other parties, the victims, and I think they came from the bank. We would have an authentication problem. But because there was testimony from the post that we went to the bank, we got bank records from the bank, and then we took it to the officers. Now, admittedly, the post only testified about going to the bank once. They did not testify about going back to the bank a second time and getting an additional set of documents and then taking those back to the officer as the officer testified. So we know that did happen. There were two sets of documents that were printed. The Popes only testified about one. I would submit that it's reasonable to infer that the Popes went and got the bank documents in the same way the second time that they got those documents the first time, and that any additional argument as to whether or not that was enough for the trial court to rely upon these documents goes to the weight of the evidence and not to whether or not they're admissible.
Doesn't it get a little dangerous to infer authenticity?
I think these are inferences that a fact finder is required to make. It's the job of the fact finder to determine whether or not he believes these documents are what the witnesses are stating that they are, and at some point, if that's allowed to go too far, then yes, the court has to step in and say, this was an abuse of discretion, this goes too far, but I don't think in this case that we have that.
Counsel, before your time runs out, can you talk a little bit about harmless error? How harmless error would play in this case?
Well, I've submitted that because there's no objection to the officer's testimony, that everything the officer testified, based on what you saw on the records, was admitted, and any objection to that is now waived. And I would submit, as I've laid out in my brief, the officer basically testified orally to every relevant piece of information that was contained in those bank records.
But if he's testifying only from the bank records, Doesn't 801, I think it's 384, provide that there's no need to keep repeating the same objection?
Provides that there's no need to keep repeating the same objection, but this would not be the same objection as the court held in Pope. An objection to the documents themselves and an objection to testimony about the documents is two separate objections, and you have to make both. And he claims, well, I couldn't have made both, because once I made the one, I knew that the second was not going to work. First of all, saying I didn't think I would succeed on the motion is not an excuse to not make the motion. And second of all, he could have made both objections the first time he objected. The objection could have been the documents themselves are inadmissible, and therefore any testimony about the documents is also inadmissible. And so there was definitely the opportunity to make both objections, and that did not happen here. As I've submitted, this case is exactly like Pope on those grounds. And as a result, the bank records themselves really add no relevant information that helps tie the defendant to the fraudulent purchase that was made in this case. He was seen on video making that purchase. We have a receipt memorializing that purchase. The bank records, admittedly, the detective probably would not have found this transaction and Mr. Martin had not been for those bank records. So they were an important part of his investigation. But once we got to trial, we had additional evidence and we had his testimony, which is not objected to, and by that point, what was contained in the bank records became cumulative and therefore harmless error.
Are you aware of any case, either in our court or the Supreme Court, where application of 518 has been used in the, or even 512 has been used in the context of a full harmless error review? In other words, where we've applied the procedural bar and then gone ahead and use the evidence.
I can cite the court to the other case that I cited, the unpublished opinion.
Montgomery?
It's Witted, the unpublished case that is similar to Pope. I cited it along with Pope. And in that case, the court, the objection was to the certificate of analysis coming in. And of course, we also had the person who did the certificate of analysis. She testified about the results that she found from her testing. And the court ultimately held that since there was no objection to her testimony, the objection was only to the certificate of analysis, the objection to the testimony was waived. And as a result, the court ultimately held that because the objection to her testimony was waived, any error in admitting the certificate itself was harmless error.
Okay.
So that is a case where it was applied, and it's an unpublished case, but it's a case where that was the ultimate outcome. And finally, just one final point of clarification. I'm not asking the court, on the substantive argument, I'm not asking the court to create some version of the federal rule 807, I think is rule of evidence. It's not what I'm asking the court to do at all. That rule has to do with actual hearsay. When you have an out-of-court person who is declarant making a hearsay statement, that rule will be inapplicable here. We don't need the additional safeguards in this context because we're talking about computer-generated information. The only reason those cases that talk about bank records are relevant to this case is in the court's application of Penny versus Commonwealth, because that footnote 3 does require the court to ask whether there's anything in the situation that indicates that these records are reliable. And as the federal circuit courts have held in the Rule 807 context, bank records, and these aren't, in those cases, there's no extra showing that there are business records, that there's anything else, they're just bank records, printouts. And the courts in those cases said the banks rely on these records, individuals rely on these records, and thus they're sufficiently reliable to get in under Rule 807. I would submit here, for the same reasons, they're sufficiently reliable to get in under the exception created in Penny versus Commonwealth, as it's enunciated in footnote 3 for situations as this. For all these reasons, unless there are any further questions from the court, I'll rest on my brief and ask the court to affirm.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Mr. McCracken?
I think I saved a minute half, didn't I?
Almost.
Basically, I disagree with his interpretation of Pope, and even if Pope were the way he said it was, it doesn't apply here. This was Pope, the trooper, was clearly testifying from his personal observations, including what he was told. The hearsay portion went to what, here that the officer is not testifying about anything other than making reference to an already admitted document. And it would be exactly the same. The statute, you quoted 801, and I go off from there, but basically says,
I think
you don't have to keep doing it.
384, I think.
Yes, sir, I think that's right. And I thought it was a very innovative argument, and he could be applauded for his argument, but basically you cannot, as judges, decide that it's a bank record, therefore it's reliable, which is essentially what he asked you to do. We don't know how those documents were generated.
He said, well, we know, everybody knows. I don't know. Some gremlin at a gas station may be picking up the phone. And I don't know that we know. I mean, we don't. And we, beyond that, we don't know. What the whole point I was making about the penny argument was that we don't know how the information that is on that screen, how that was put, you know, that what he's said is clearly a computer screen dump. We don't know whose screen dump it was. We know it wasn't the teller that the son talked about because these documents were generated 10 days later. We don't know who generated those documents, and we don't know the source. Even their chain of custody argument falls apart. But insofar as how that information got on the computer screen, there is no evidence of that. Without that, I mean, the whole point of those pen registers, and this is not a Sixth Amendment argument, it's a hearsay argument. We don't care whether it's prepared for prosecution, that's not the test. The test is it something that basically was created in a fashion such that when the information was encoded, it automatically went into a registry of records that are reasonably relied on by the business. And there's simply nothing here. We don't know where that information came from or how it got on that particular document. They didn't meet their burden. And Pope is not applicable. We didn't have, every time the trooper said, yeah, if you look at that document, you know, it's got a number on it, and you can take that number and look at that number. We don't have to keep standing up and objecting. The judge has already made a ruling as to the admissibility of that information.
Very well.
Thank you very much.
We'll step down and greet counsel, and then the court will be adjourned.